Welcome to Gambling with an Edge with your hosts Bob Dancer and Richard Munchkin. Bob Dancer is America's premier video poker writer and teacher. He's written 10 books, including Video Poker for the Intelligent Beginner and the best-selling Million Dollar Video Poker. He helped develop the computer software Video Poker for Winners, and in 2004, he was inducted into the Video Poker Hall of Fame. Richard Munchkin has been a professional Advantage player for over 30 years and is in the Blackjack Hall of Fame. His book, Gambling Wizards, Conversations with the World's Greatest Gamblers, is a testament to the many ways you can succeed at gambling. The goal of the show is that you'll be a more knowledgeable gambler tomorrow than you were yesterday. And now, here are Bob and Richard.
Good evening. Welcome to Gambling with an Edge. I'm Bob. How are you tonight, Richard?
I'm quite well, quite well. Happy to be here.
Good. Looking forward to tonight's interview. We're going to be talking to Stanford Wong on a controversial subject, dice control, which is most forms of advantage gambling are not so controversial, but this one is. So looking forward to it.
Yeah, yeah, I agree.
Halloween is approaching. Halloween is a scary holiday. So I thought this would be as good a time as any to talk about video poker scares. In general, a video poker scare is when the last card you drew could have made a royal flush, but didn't. For example, if you start out by drawing two cards to ace, king, queen of hearts, if the first card is the jack of hearts and the last card is a black seven, that's a scare. If the first card is a black seven and the last card is a jack of hearts, that's not a scare. If you were playing five play and you missed all five times, it counts as five scares. And you have the right to groan when that happens. Usually, the figure assumed for the average number of scares between royals is 47. That's approximately correct, although different people count scares in different ways. For example, if the first four cards drawn were the king, ten, ace, queen of diamonds, and the fifth card was a spade, most players count that as a scare on the draw and a scare on the deal, because in both cases, if the right card had come out there, it would have been a royal. Now,
you got two scares.
Pardon?
You got two scares in one hand.
Right. Now, that's fine as long as we're only playing single-line games. But what if you're playing 10-play? Now, certainly counting 10 misses at the end, that's appropriate, but when you on the deal, is that one or 10? Did you, and some people count it as one on the deal and 10 on the draw, and some count it as 10 on each. So generally this doesn't matter, except people will tell you things like it has been 113 scares since the last time they hit a royal, or they've had 219, or some such big number. And what they're really trying to say is, I've been running badly recently. Please feel sorry for me. I need your sympathy. In the long, it doesn't matter. Over, say, a career of 10,000 scares, you're going to have several rings of more than 200 scares, and sometimes you get only two or three between a royal.
Like one of those things that in the early days when people were mistrustful of, you know, is the machine really dealing honestly, it would be a way of sort of checking that you're, you know, hitting as often as you should, you know.
And some people use it for that context. Most people do not keep the numbers accurately enough to be a legitimate check on that. The missing on your next 200 scares, we're assuming it's 1 in 47 each time to hit it, missing 200 the next 200 times is about 1 in 74. That's not a huge long shot. It's bad luck. It's five cycles, where a cycle would be, well, it's actually it's not five cycles. It's about five cycles, where 47 is 1, it's 4.5 cycles. Now, this 1 in 74, though, only applies if you're looking at the next 200 scares or any 200 scares starting from a specific point. If you're looking at the last 200 scare interval, the 1 in 74 number is meaningless. Because over a lifetime, you're going to have several 200 scare situations. And if the only time you talk about it is when it's actually happening, I mean, that it's almost 100% that you're going to have a 200 scare interval sometime during your career. So most gamblers whine. Scares are just a way that video poker players can numericize their whining. Now, Munch, you're not a video poker player, but I assume you've been around whining players forever. In other gambling games, what other ways do players numericize their whining?
For table games players, scares usually involve something to do with security. You'll see pit bosses congregating, looking at you, maybe security guards.
You're afraid you're going to be busted or run out or backroomed or something like that.
Exactly. Although often that it turns out to be the boss is calling a host over to say, hey, go, that guy's playing without a card. You should go talk to him, and try to get him to, he's playing big and get him a player's card.
If they do that to you, you'll tell them you'll gladly take dinner for two in the diner, but you don't want to give them your name.
Yeah, and of course they don't give you the dinner for two unless you, unless you give them ID so they can get you a player's card. So it's all a dance. But there have been some pretty comical scare stories for table games.
Yeah, players. Like what?
One story was about a player from Atlantic City who was coming out to Las Vegas for the first time, and in Atlantic City. They can't bar you, so you have a lot less shenanigans. But he had heard all these stories about being backroomed and being barred, and he was really nervous about it. So he went out to Las Vegas, and he was winning, and he had all these chips, and he started to think he was getting heat. So he got up from the table, and he noticed a security guard looking at him strangely, and he ducked behind the slot machines and was really getting nervous. So he ducked into the bathroom, went into a stall, and he's sitting there counting his chips, and all of a sudden his head comes over the stall door, and it's the security guard saying, "What are you doing?" And he says, I'm just counting my chips. And the security guard says, "In the woman's bathroom."
Oh, dear. Oh, dear. Good. That's actually happened to me once in my life. It was not in the casino. And I just noticed the shoes underneath the stall next to me were not male shoes, and I go, oh dear. So finished what I needed to do and ran out of there, left the restaurant immediately. So that was kind of embarrassing. All right, good. So that's one case. You said there were a couple?
Oh yeah. Well, there was one that happened to my brother a long time ago. He was playing in the Tropicana, and
So we're gonna give your brother a name for this, or a real name or a fake name? What are we gonna call him?
We'll call him Jake.
Jake, okay.
Yeah, so he was playing in the Tropicana, and he was betting green chips at the time, and there was a high roller at the table betting multiple black chips, not with him, just happened to be at the same table. And
uh-huh.
The shift manager was talking with the high roller. And in the middle of his conversation, he turned and he looked at my brother, and he said, are you a card counter? And my brother said, but no. Well, of course he was. And or is.
What a liar they are in your family, Richard. Go
yeah.
ahead.
And he said, are you sure you're not a card counter? My brother says, no. Why do you say that? And he goes, well, those guys over there think you're a card counter. And he points at the other pit bosses. And my brother says, well, why do they think that? And the shift manager says, I don't know. Let me go ask them. So he walks over there. He talks to them. He comes back with a Griffin flyer with a big picture of my brother's face.
Oh, dear.
And my brother is not, a nondescript guy, and shows him the picture, and he says, well, they say this looks like you. My
uh-huh.
brother says, well, it does kind of look like me, but that's not me. And the boss says, Do you swear you're not a card counter?
Really? Yeah. Did they bring a stack of Bibles for this to swear on?
He says, yeah, I swear. He goes, all right, raise your right hand and repeat after me.
Oh, dear.
As my brother raises his right hand, stands up in the Tropicana, and the guy says, I swear I'm not a card counter. My brother says, I swear I'm not a card counter.
All right.
Okay, and just walks away.
Well, that proves he's not a card counter.
And, you know, my brother played for a few more hands and then left. I mean, you know, they're not going to let you win any money at that point. But one of my teammates happened to have been in the trap and saw this happen.
Uh-huh.
And came back to the house. He said, you're not going to believe what I just saw happen to your brother.
Yeah. So did your brother voluntarily tell you, or did you tell him what happened?
Yeah, no, he came back and said, you're not going to believe. And I was like, I already heard the story. he was happy somebody was there to see it, so nobody would think he was making it up.
All right, good. All right, and then you had one more story, and then we're going to talk to Mr. Wong.
One more scare. There was, many years ago, there was a hole card team playing in Caesar's Palace.
And a hole card team is what?
They were playing blackjack, and one player is the big player betting the money, and the other is reading the whole card and signaling that information to the big player.
Okay.
And which is not illegal, by the way.
Unless you're at the Four Winds in Michigan.
Right. In this particular case, the reader was trying to get very low, and so he was in a wheelchair to get his eyes lowered to the table.
Yep.
And so they were playing, and unbeknownst to them, somewhere on the other side behind them in the casino, a guy had had a heart attack. And the guy in the wheelchair suddenly sees the boss frantically signaling to security and pointing over in their general direction. And
security
comes at a dead run, and the guy in the wheelchair thinks that they're coming after him.
Uh-huh.
And he jumps up out of the wheelchair and runs out of the casino.
Oh, dear.
And the dealer looks at the big player, and the big player throws his hands in the air and says, praise Jesus, it's a miracle.
Okay, good. That would be a miracle. I suspect that big player left rather quickly after that as well.
Yes.
All right. So, apparently we lost Mr. Wong. So we're going to get him back. And while we're waiting for him to get back, let me talk a little bit about the South Point. They have more than 10,000 video poker games, returning more than 99%, which is more than anyone else. They have free online poker tournaments, hundreds of them a day, at southpointpoker.com. They actually have some where they have daily winners with two winners on one day, on two different days. So the nine players come back to the casino in a couple weeks, and the winner of that nine-person final table gets a $10,000 seat in next year's World Series of Poker. Double Points in October will be happening on Halloween, midnight to midnight. I will be on the Quick Quads machine. This week's class is called Secrets of a Video Poker Winner. This is things such as when money management, when to change games, what game should each person be playing, dealing with the IRS. I'm getting signals here that we just got Stanford Wong back on, and so I was a little bit distracted. All right. So the Secrets class starts at 1 o'clock on Wednesday. Everyone is invited. Now, Stanford Wong is primarily known as a blackjack author, but he's written about a number of other gaming subjects as well. We've had him on the show twice before. Tonight, we're going to be discussing his book, Wong on Dice, which discusses and defends the practice of dice control. This is Stanford Wong's third visit. Earlier visits, we discussed his book, Professional Blackjack, March 31st, and Casino Tournament Strategy, May 26th. Both of those interviews can be downloaded from bobdancer.com. Stanford Wong, welcome to Gambling with an Edge.
Well, thank you very much for inviting me.
It's a pleasure to have you. Before we get started, I made an accidental mistake in the article I posted earlier this week on the LasVegasAdvisor.com blog that I have every Tuesday. I wrote that Frank Scolbletti and Henry Tamburan were partners in the Golden Touch Dice Control series. Henry Tamburan emailed me to say that he was not involved in this particular operation and that Scolbetti's main partner in this operation is Dominic Larigio, who goes by the name of Dominator. So I apologize for this misstatement. So,
well, Henry does work with them, so it's not a bad misstatement. It's not like somebody who's the polar opposite.
Yeah, they do other projects together, and Henry did say that he has seen both Frank and the Dominator roll dice many times, and if he has, whenever he has a chance to bet on their rolls, he will do it. So,
Henry's the one that got me into dice too. He was in her office, we were talking about it, and I was sort of acting like, well, dice is something that I should just ignore. And he was saying, well, you know, you shouldn't really just ignore it. You should at least look into it and then make a decision. And so I looked into it and I liked what I saw. And if it wouldn't have been for Henry, I wouldn't have gotten in it in the first place.
All right. So do you think in the long, since that was 5 or 6 years ago, do you thank Henry for this or blame him for this?
I don't know. I did get a book out of it, which is positive, although it's not a very fast seller. I'm basically a net loser on dice, so I've lost a little money at it, but I've had a lot of fun with it. You know, what I have fun with it is just like I used to really enjoy playing golf and bowling, even though I was never really good at either one. I just enjoy doing things with my body, and this is a physical skill. It's totally different than say blackjack, which you just sit there, your body doesn't doing anything, you're using your brain only when you're trying to throw dice and trying to get both dice to move the same. Why it's really much more similar to trying to hit the ball off the tee at a golf course.
You know, so in the book you had said that you practiced at home for 2 months, and then in the book it said I've been a winner at dice since then, but you're now saying that since the time the book came out you must have had some losses, so that overall you're a net negative?
I was ahead at dice for the first 2 or 3 years, and then what happened was I decided to increase my bet sizes, and I thought that there were other people who were doing a better job of tossing dice than I was, so I thought it made sense to bet more when other people were throwing the dice. And then I had a couple of kind of disastrous trips there that I don't know if I'm actually a winner betting only on my own tosses or not, but it was when I was trying to, you know, sort of go up and scale a little bit by putting money out there on other people's tosses. So that's when I lost, and I haven't got that back yet.
So do you still believe that this is a possible way to make money?
I would say it's possible, but I would say it's very difficult. I really look at the parallels with other sports, especially golf. Is it possible to hit the ball long and straight and down the middle of the fairway? Well, yes, it's possible. Could I do it? Well, right now I can't. Could I do it at one time? Well, at one time I could, but it's the sort of thing that you think you're on because you hit 3 or 4 balls down the middle of the fairway, and then the next hole the ball tails off to the right, you know, a slice or hooks or you push it or something, and it's just difficult to keep doing it. Any little thing you do wrong is going to affect your end result negatively.
So but you've seen the instructors who work for the Golden Touch, and they impress you with their abilities, and you believe they could actually make a living at this.
You know, it's very complicated. One thing is these people like at Golden Touch, for example, when they're on a practice table, they can do well. They all have SRRs of 1 to 7, which means they're not random throwing. They're getting just enough influence on the dice to where they could have an edge if they can do that in a casino. But sometimes doing it on a practice table in the comfort of your home doesn't translate into doing it in a casino. and sometimes doing it, you know, when there's no people around, you're rested, there's no excitement or anything, doesn't translate into doing it in the middle of a casino where there's a cocktail waitress bugging you to see if you want a drink, and there's casino employees watching you, and there's other players around crowding you, you know, shoulder to shoulder, and bets on the table that sometimes your dice bounce off of. But just because you can do it at home on your private table doesn't mean you can do it in a casino.
So for people who are, you know, interested in gambling with an edge, this sounds like a really kind of a dangerous pursuit. I mean, maybe something recreational, but not something to take seriously to try to make money at, it sounds like.
You know, I think that's just a real good attitude to take, that if you want to get serious about making money from casinos, do something that's more dependable. Get into blackjack. Get into video poker. Get into poker. Get into something where the mathematics is fairly well-defined. And, you know, a blackjack player, for example, goes 3, 4, 5 months losing. He doesn't get worried and say, gee, maybe the minus counts is where I have an edge. Maybe the casino has the best of it at positive counts or something. He doesn't doubt himself because the mathematics has been so well established by so many people that the player doesn't have to use his own personal result of the last few months to estimate his long-run edge. He knows what his long-run edge is by computer work. But dice is different. I mean, dice, you can have a couple of months that everything is going bad, and can you tell yourself, well, I really have an edge over this. If I keep going, things are going to turn around. Well, you can't tell yourself that because you don't know that. You have to base your future on what's happened in your own personal past. And, you know, that's just much more difficult than basing your future on hard numbers that a computer spits out.
In a way, poker is very similar because, you know, you could go on a long losing streak at poker and really not know if you're a winning player or just unlucky, you know?
That's exactly right, because poker is partially a matter of mathematics. You can know the proper strategy, essentially basic strategy for poker, but if you've got some weaknesses that your opponents know how to take advantage of, you've got to tell that they know whether your hand is weak or strong by watching some mannerism that you're totally unaware of. You can be a losing poker player even though you think you're doing everything right, and dice is the same way. You might think you're a winning dice player, but if you're aligning the dice wrong, you know, just a little bit of an angle wrong or too much spin with one finger compared to another finger, something like that, why you can be a loser even though everybody compliments you on how pretty your throw is.
Back in 2004, when you were just writing this book, a lot of people you respect on BJ21 were thinking maybe you were smoking some wacky tobacco or something on this dice control. And so there were some challenges where people put money up. Tell us about those.
Well, that was kind of interesting. There was a challenge. I thought of that one day as I was on a long run. I was thinking, what can I do to publicize this new book? And I thought, well, if it really works, I think it does work, why not do something to get people talking about it? And so I posted a challenge. We worked out the details. I think the original, in fact, I think what I originally posted turned out to be the details of 500 tosses, and those 500 tosses that I would get less than 80 sevens, where 83 and a third would be random. And I figured, you know, less than 80 should be doable. And there were people who were willing to put money up against me, so I took on all comers for that. And at that time, I was practicing quite a bit. And I knew from keeping track of what I was doing in the casino that I was throwing the dice well enough to have an edge in the challenge. And I found another guy to join me in it, Little Joe Green, who also was throwing the dice well enough to do that. So I had confidence going into that challenge that we would be able to throw fewer than 87s out of 500 tosses. And in fact, we did. But I don't think I would repeat that challenge now. At least I wouldn't be one of the participants. If I could find two other people who were doing good, I'd back them to throw fewer than 80. But, I had about a window there, maybe 6 months or 8 months, when I was throwing very well. And then after the challenge was over, I stopped practicing so much, and the quality of my throws went downhill. And, it's not an annual challenge. I couldn't have done it annually. There was just that one time back in the...
Well, you could have done it had you decided it was worth it and you practiced. But you just...
Yes, yes.
Why did you stop?
It's a combination of, like... Well, you know what I've always done? Every book I've written, I've gotten really into it, basically worked on it full time until the book was finished and sent off to get manufactured. And then I sort of lost interest in that subject and turned my attention to something else. That's what I did with my book on tournaments. That's what I did with my book on sports betting. That's what I did with basically all the books I've written. And so Dice was just following the same pattern, working on it very intensively until the book is shipped off to get manufactured. And then, you know, it's like, okay, let's take a vacation from Dice. I've been working on this full time for too many months.
When we originally set this interview up, we were going to have Michael Shackelford on. And Michael is somebody all three of us respect. And he's a skeptic when it comes to dice control. And so Michael was a little bit leery on it simply because he has respect for you and didn't want to have it out that, well, Shaq is against Wong. So we wrote you about it, and you actually indicated that for the most part, you and Michael are in agreement on most things about dice, which when I read that, I thought that was pretty amazing because your book is an endorsement of dice control, a justification for dice control, and Michael is a skeptic on this. So how is it that you think that your view and Michael's view are almost identical?
Well, at the time I put the book together, and, of course, it's still the same book I wrote 2004, 2005, something like that. It hasn't been revised. We're still selling on the first printing. And I think now I would be a little bit, I don't know quite what the word is. I wouldn't be quite so positive. At the time I put together, for example, I had never viewed any slow-motion film of how much dice bounce around after they hit the felt. And we took some slow-motion videos a couple of years ago, and boy, those dice really spin and twirl and bounce crazy. I sort of made it sound in the book like dice hitting the felt wasn't that big a deal. Well, it is that big a deal. And also now I've got the benefit of a lot more hours in the casino. Now I realize that it's not like you just like ride a bicycle that you build a skill and you keep it for the rest of your life. It's really more like golf or tennis that you just have to practice. If you lay off a couple of weeks and don't practice, while your skill erodes very quickly. I didn't put that in the book, but if I were to revise it, I'd put those things in the book.
Did your wife enjoy having a craps table in her living room?
I thought about it, but we did not get a craps table in the house. See, the main problem with them is they're awfully heavy. Once you put them in, they dominate the room. It's not something like a folding ping pong table that if you're going to have people over and you want to use room for something else, you fold up the table and lean it up against the wall. You don't fold up a crap table and lean it up against the wall. It really dominates that room for as long as you have it. So I just I just couldn't justify putting one in our house.
Yeah, I have a friend who had one in his living room for over a year, and you can imagine his wife was not thrilled with that at all. when you had this challenge, you asked some of the Golden Touch people to be part of it, right, to throw, and they declined. Why do you think that was?
I didn't really need them for that. I invited them, but that was more of a polite invitation. I thought we could do without them. But when there was a chance for a follow-up, then I was more serious about getting them to participate because at that time my throws weren't going real well and little Joe was just working too much and not practicing anymore, so he was sort of out of the picture. And so I just couldn't find any people willing to do it. And I'm not sure exactly why. Maybe they saw no upside to them because everybody sort of accepts Golden Touch as people that know what they're doing. And so if they won, you know, no benefit, but if they lost, maybe their reputation would be hurt big time. That's one possibility. I don't know what it was. All I know is I gave them the opportunity, and they turned me down. And, of course, I didn't try to twist any arms or anything. I just said, okay, if you don't want to do it, then there's no challenge.
You know, in the book, you were quite positive about Golden Touch. You had very good things to say. You recommended them. They charged several $1,000. For that class, don't they? And are you still as positive on them as you were?
I have no idea how much they charged. I know they do have a money-back guarantee that if there's a customer that for some reason is unhappy and wants his money back, they'll give it. So I look at that as making totally legit. And when I took it, now I didn't have to pay. They gave it to me for a comp. But when I took it, I was probably the only comp in there, and all the other people, it was, I think, a two-day class and maybe 3 days. I forgot what. But basically, after the first half a day, everybody thought they'd gotten their money's worth already. I mean, they really, you know, they've got happy customers. So, and I'm still positive on it. This is one of those things, you know, if you said, for example, that you're interested in learning to play tennis, what would I recommend? I would say go with a tennis pro. Learn how to play tennis from somebody who knows how to teach you. And I would say the same thing if you wanted to learn to play golf, for example. Well, why should craps be any different? Why not learn from somebody who knows what to, you know, what to do, knows how to tell you what to do, and can watch you when you're throwing the dice and can make corrections in your delivery to try to get it right. You know, the Golden Touch people do it. They deliver.
The Nevada cheating statute defines cheating. It means to alter the elements of chance, method of selection, or criteria which determine the results of a game. Is dice control altering the element of chance?
You know, when you get down close to the line, and I'd have to say the dice control is probably close to the line, it depends on interpretation. It depends on how the casino people interpret it, how the state interprets it, how the law interprets it. I'm not aware of anybody ever getting in trouble for attempting a controlled toss. The only people who have gotten in trouble for throwing the dice are doing things like sliding it across the table. If you take one die and you put it so a six is up and you slide it so that six stays up instead of the dice tumbling, that's cheating. But as long as you throw the dice and they go through the air and not slide along the table and bounce off the back wall, that's what you got to do. If you can do those two things, get them in the air and bounce off the back wall, then as far as all the casinos that I'm aware of are concerned, it's a legal throw. Now, the people who are supervising the game, if they don't like the way you throw the dice, they do have the right to take countermeasures. For example, they can say, please hit the back wall. If you don't, we're going to call no roll. Or they can actually call no roll. Or they can say, hit the back roll harder. They can say, make the dice bounce back further. And they can enforce it by saying, if you don't throw the dice the way we tell you to, we're going to take the dice away from you and give them to the next shooter. I've never had that happen to me, but I've heard of that happening to people.
Well, in the most recent issue of Blackjack Insider, Frank Scalbetti writes about his team being kicked out of the Bellagio because of their success at dice control. Do you have any idea if this is a rare event or a common event? I mean, blackjack players get kicked out all the time.
I don't think it's common. I have heard of other players being kicked out of a casino because somebody in a casino doesn't like the way they throw the dice. It's not near as common as blackjack players. And I think with dice, it happens more as your bet level increases. You know, the casinos give much more scrutiny to $1,000 bets than they do to $10 bets. So I have no idea how much Scalbetti and his team were betting. But it may be the combination of multiple people and one person in the casino decides he doesn't like what he sees, then they can get kicked out. But it's not going to happen. It's not going to happen at too many casinos. Bellagio might be the only one for him.
In your book, both you and Bryce Carlson mentioned that as soon as you started up in your bets, the heat increased tremendously. I mean, my impression from the book was that once you got to the green chip level, they already started giving you heat or causing you problems about the way you were throwing the dice. Is that the case?
You know, it's just like blackjack. It depends on the casino. There are some casinos in Las Vegas where green chips draw attention, and there's other casinos where black chips don't even draw attention. You got to get up into $500, $1,000 bets before anybody pays any attention to you.
Do you know anybody who's made a lot of money doing this? I mean, six figures?
The only person I know has been winning right from the get-go. He's been winning for a long time and still winning is a guy who calls himself the Mad Professor. I know of two other people, you know, green chippers on my website that got way ahead of the game and increased their bets, and they thought they had the ticket to the bank there, and then all of a sudden they started losing and lost it all back. There's one guy that got $150,000 ahead and then lost that $150,000 back and quit, and another fellow actually got $1.5 million ahead, increasing his bets all the time, and he managed to lose that $1.5 million back, and now both of those gentlemen, including the one that lost, you know, one who lost $1.5 million, they both think that they were just lucky when they were winning, and that they really don't have an edge over the game, and neither one of them plays craps anymore.
Huh.
But especially that fellow that was $1.5 million ahead, I kind of look at that, and I really wished I would have been there watching him as he was doing it, because I suspect that maybe in order to get that much ahead of the game, the guy really did have some skill at winning money at craps. And if he would have, as you started losing, you know, craps is just like any other game. You get your good days, you get your bad days. In blackjack, you have to decrease your bet after extended losing streaks so you don't get wiped out. Well, a crap shooter should decrease his bet after extended losing streaks so he doesn't get wiped out. And so for a person to you know, get way ahead and then lose it all back, that says something about poor money management, that maybe as they hit the, an unfortunate losing streak, they didn't cut their bets back the way they should have. And if they would have used better money management, maybe they'd still be winning money from the casinos at dice. I don't know that. All I know is that both guys do now act and say that they really don't have an edge over dice at all. They were just lucky to get that far ahead, and now they've lost it all back.
In your book, you talk about practicing on your bed rather than on a table, on a crap table. That seems weird that you practice rolling dice on a bed. How did that work?
Well, the only thing that you have any control over whatsoever is what happens to the dice between the time you pick them up and the time they leave your fingers. Once you're no longer touching them, they're on autopilot. You don't have any control over them anymore. They're going to do what they want to. Now, the advantage of throwing on a table is you can see what happens to them after it hit the table, after it hit the back wall, how they bounce around it all. And, of course, when you're just throwing onto a bed, there's no bouncing around on the tabletop and bouncing off the back wall for you to observe. But in terms of the things that you have control over, are the dice flying exactly together, or is one higher or lower, one ahead of the other? Are they both rotating exactly together, or is one rotating faster than the other? You know, those things you can see no matter where you're throwing dice. You can be throwing them to a swimming pool if you want to. So
throwing them on your swimming pool, you could, to improve your technique?
Well, no, I was just giving that as a wild example. And, you know, then you'd have to dive in after them, so it's... Actually, I don't even know if dice float or not.
How many hours do you think it takes to learn to do this, to actually have an edge? I mean, hours of practice?
Well, there's two things. One is you have to get some instruction with somebody like the Golden Touch people so that when you're practicing good habits. If you're practicing bad habits, it doesn't matter how many hours you put in, you know, like practicing bad habits at tennis or golf, you're still going to be a lousy tennis player, lousy golfer if you're practicing bad habits. But if you know what to do, know what you're supposed to do, and you practice good habits, I'm not sure. I was trying to remember how many hours a day I worked at it and for how many months. It's undoubtedly an individual thing too.
Whether if you're a natural athlete or a natural klutz, that would.
Yeah, the guy that got the $1.5 million ahead, I think, only practiced for a month or two, and then he took on the casinos. He's got some natural athletic ability there to pick it up that quickly. I do remember that as I was practicing, it just sort of everything came together all at once. That I was my dice were looking better and better, but they were random, you know, in terms of casino results. And then all of a sudden one day I just started getting them to fly exactly together, and my results at the table were showing that they were going together. And I took somebody with me to the casino to, you know, have an independent count of total tosses and total sevens, so I wouldn't have to rely on my own count there, that maybe I was you know, thinking I was good, but actually I was just miscounting or something. And so people I took with me to count my tosses came up with the same numbers I did, that that I actually had an edge over the casino. And, you know, just all of a sudden it came together for me. And I would guess that's what it is for most people, that, you know, just all of a sudden you got it. And, whether it's, I think it's a matter of months. I mean, it's not something you can just do in 2 or 3 days. I would say it's probably going to be a matter of months for, unless you're just exceptionally talented. Michael Jordan could probably pick it up in 3 days.
Well, he has, his gambling history would give him a lot of cover. He could, he could put a lot of money down without a lot of heat. That's for sure. Yes.
I think that he would get attention right away, though. You know, I can sort of blend in and be anonymous, but Michael Jordan could not be anonymous. If he got a reputation of being a good dice thrower, why, he would find the welcome mat withdrawn all over the place, I'm sure.
Well, except he's played so much in casinos, and he's lost so much in
don't
casinos.
Think loser. Yeah.
I would think
no, the casinos don't think that way. They don't say, well, you've already lost all this money. We're going to let you play with an edge for a while to win some of your money back. No, no, that's not the way they think. Once you start playing with an edge, they don't want you anymore, even if you've already lost big time.
But what if he gives them an autograph? Wouldn't that count for something?
You know, I want to ask about all the controlled throwers seem to talk about how that the individual tables make a big difference, that there are only certain tables that are good for this. What are the tables that they're looking for?
Well, some of the tables, the dice are just way too bouncy. And you definitely don't want something where the dice just bounce all over the place. The more they bounce, the more randomness there is there. There's also
does that
some tables,
the amount of padding on the table?
Yeah, the more padding makes them bouncier.
What about
what you like is a hard table. If you feel it with your fingers, and your fingers don't go into that felt at all, that's a good table for throwing. And if you put your fingers on the felt and you press down and it's soft, your fingers just sink right in, then that's not really a table that you want to be throwing dice at.
Do you want new felt or old felt?
Old felt is better.
And why is that?
I think new felt is just, I don't know if the fibers are stretched too much or something, but old felt, the dice just seem to behave better.
But not.
But
so.
There's a whole lot of things. For example, some people, if you're not at least 6 foot tall, there's some crap tables that are just too high. It's difficult to lean over. There's not uniformity in crap tables. Some are higher than others. Some are wider than others. Some have strange shapes. They come all different lengths. Most people prefer the 12-footers, but there's a lot of 15-footers around. It makes it more difficult. There's just a lot of considerations. The layout goes fairly close to the far end of the table. So when you throw your dice, if there are people with bets there, it's difficult for your dice to land and bounce around without hitting somebody's bet. So you like a table that has more empty felt there, so your dice can roll around a little bit without hitting chips.
So at first blush, it would seem like you want to play at empty tables, but then that would give a whole lot of workers concentrating on you, which doesn't sound like what you want at all.
Right. There's advantages both ways. At a full table, so you're talking about an average of 8.5 rolls per shooter for a random shooter. So if there's 10 other people at the table, on average, you're going to throw the dice 85 times before it's your turn to throw the dice again. If you're getting 80 hands an hour, then you're going to have to, you know, you seven out, you got to wait an hour for the dice to come around to you again. Whereas if you're alone at the table, you seven out, boom, they give the dice right back to you. But yes, you're right, that if you're only one at the table, the dealers and the stick person can be talking about you and you're sort of vulnerable. I've had that happen where one of the dealers says, you know, if I owned this casino, I wouldn't let this guy throw a dice here. And, you know, the other dealer is saying the same sort of thing and a stick person saying the same thing. And I'm thinking, gee, I wish some other customer would walk up. I wouldn't be the only customer here. I wouldn't have to take this. But
it does seem that to try to make this controlled throw, it does look really obvious what you're doing. I mean, you can spot these people a mile away. So it doesn't surprise me that they get heat immediately if they start winning or start betting any serious money.
Yeah, both the guys who were way ahead, you know, the guy 150,000 ahead and the guy 1.5 million ahead, both of them basically wore out their welcome all over Las Vegas. there were very few places that they could play it anymore by the time they were ready to lose their money back to them, because everybody else had kicked them out. So that does happen.
Stanford, I want to thank you for coming on. We're running out of time. If somebody wants to get this book from your website, where do they go?
BJ21.com is our website, and we have an order form right there. You put in name and address and credit card number, and we'll take care of it.
Thank you. We've asked the toughest questions we can on this. You've been very candid, and thank you very much.
Well, thank you for inviting me. This is fun.
All right, good. We'll have you on again someday soon. Richard, what did you learn?
Well, I was actually pretty shocked. I expected him to be a much bigger advocate for this, and now it sounds like
he's
mellowed. Mellowed, or maybe
seen the light
that maybe this is fine, you know, for a recreational gambler or something, but this is not a way to try to be an advantage player, I don't think.
Interesting.
What about you? I mean,
well, yeah. When I read the book, I was ready to start sweet talking Shirley into putting a dice table in the living room. I don't know that I'd ever be successful at that. But he now doesn't seem to be so suggestive of it. Although, you know, Henry Tamburin is not an excitable guy, and he says he's watched Scobletti and he's watched Dominic throw, and he's willing to bet on him. And Henry's pretty tight when it comes to what he's going to bet on. So I think I'm have a mixed view and not likely to take it up myself.
No, yeah.
Let's talk about some of our sponsors. The Palms. The drawing this month is called the $78,000 Trick-or-Treat Money Bags Drawing. Drawings are held Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. So this will be the last weekend of this month. If you're selected, five people each night, the average is a little under $1,400. The high is $4,000, and the low is $500. I have not seen what the drawings are going to be like in November, but when we know, we will tell you. The Play, Earn, and Win, Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, is a tool theme. You can get an electric drill. You can get a hand truck. You can get a toolbox. You can get screwdrivers, that type of thing. I didn't get my mailer yet. By the time I left today, somebody got theirs yesterday, said that the 1st and the 3rd of next month will be double point days for everyone at the Palms. So we have to verify this, but that will be before our next show. And so at least if you're somebody who plays at the Palms, that's something to put on your calendar or something that you may want to look at. Double point days at that casino are very rare, because it's usually they use the play, earn, and win in lieu of points, in lieu of double point days. At the M Casino, what promotion you get depends on what day it is. There's the point multipliers on Monday. It's a mystery multiplier. There are lotto drawings on Wednesday. There are senior events on Wednesday. There's hot seat drawings on Friday. They also have their ongoing play a few points and get a free buffet. This is one of the better buffets in town. And playing for a rather low number of points, you get a free buffet. The next month, they will have some extra poker tournaments. Now, 11-11-11, which is the 11th day of November in 2011. They're having a tournament. They're having an event on in Poker Room. If you flop four aces, everybody at your table gets $1,111. And if you make four aces, everyone gets $111. Now, I have not worked out how easy either of these things are to do, but it's got this fact that they're there gives you more of an advantage than it would on another day. They have several other new promotions, including Omaha Bad Beats, Turkey Tournament, Progressive High Hand Jackpots, and NFL Cash Giveaways. So you see the poker room for information about that. Next week, we have Avery Cardoza. Avery is the owner of the Gambler Book Store, or sometimes called Gambler Book Club. That is his, had several locations through the years. It's currently on Eastern near Russell. It is, Avery has written something like 20 books, mostly nonfiction, on all sorts of gambling. He's written on video poker, on poker tournaments, on blackjack, on various gambling situations. Recently, he put out his first novel. It's called Lost in Las Vegas. We're going to be talking about that. It is a novel about two sad sacks from Brooklyn who spend a weekend from hell in Las Vegas. So nobody's ever spent such a worse weekend. They have they run into the mob, the FBI, the serial killers, and this beautiful girlfriend with more neurotic than anybody you've ever met. A whole series of these things. Anyway, that book's called Lost in Las Vegas. It is quite interesting. In 2 weeks, we're going to have I. Nelson Rose on, and we'll be asking him things about the Full Tilt Poker and internet gambling and that sort of thing.
I have, before we go, I wanted to mention that people should be on be very careful going between Las Vegas and Mesquite. A couple of weeks ago,
this is going to be a 2-minute story because that's how much time we have.
Oh, okay. Well, anyway, a couple of weeks ago, the police stopped a guy in a truck and asked him the old, "You don't mind if we search your vehicle, do you?"
Huh.
And the guy said he didn't mind, and they found $150,000 in cash, which they confiscated. His story was that he was headed to Salt Lake City to a meatpacking company there. I don't know what the money was for, but the bottom line was the police took it. So just this week, the police pulled over a friend of mine on his way back to Las Vegas from Mesquite. They pulled him over for nothing, basically, and just kept, you know, talking to him, asking him questions, and of course then finally got to the, "You don't mind if we search your car, do you?" And he did the right thing, which Bob Nersessian told us about, which was to say, "I do not give you permission to search my vehicle. Am I free to go?" And they let him go. So while he was driving back, after that stop, on the other side of the highway, he saw another car that had been pulled over, and police were with flashlights down on their knees looking under the seats and searching the car. So once they got $150,000 and saw how easy it is to take money from people, they're out there in force now trying to get some more. So be careful going to and from Mesquite.
And Bob Nersessian also told us that when you have these conversations with the police, have your iPhone or other smartphone turned on and record it. It is quite legal to do this. And we got
public conversations.
We got 3 seconds to go. Go out and hit lots of royal flushes.
Gambling Good night, with everybody. An Edge with your hosts, Bob Dancer and Richard Munchkin. Subscribe to the show in iTunes, and episodes will be delivered to you automatically every week. Archived versions of past shows may be found at bobdancer.com and richardmunchkin.com. We welcome emails at gamblingwithanedge@gmail.com. Bob Dancer and Richard Munchkin are both available on Facebook and welcome your questions. The sponsors for the show are the South Point Hotel, Casino, and Spa, the M Resort, the Palms Casino Resort, and the website videopoker.com. Join us again next week for another Gambling with an Edge.